Between the Trees by Kevin Linehan.
Now, there's more than enough stew in the pot to last till Sunday, said Martin's father as he threw his long brown coat around his broad shoulders and picked up a large leather satchel from the floor by the doorway. And what are you not to do? He leaned over so his thick, bearded face was level with his son's. Well? Martin leaned back as the stench of brandy on his father's breath burned his eyes slightly.
We're not to go in the woods for nothing,
he whimpered, trying to blink the tears out of his eyes.
But, Dad, where you going?
By Jesus, lad, I told ye, his father roared, standing up straight. The thing that took your mother from us is out in them woods, and I aim to get her back.
But, Dad, Martin whined pitifully, it was a bad dose of consumption that took mother. The doctor said so.
What the bloody hell does he know? He roared back, showering his son's face with spittle. A bloody butcher that man is!
Martin's face compressed into a grimace as tears started to run out of his eyes. His father's rough, pitted face softened as he got down on one knee.
Come on now, son. Don't you be doing that. You're 11 now and you have to look after your brother and sister while I'm gone.
He stood up and slapped his hand on Martin's shoulder, where it left a damp sweat stain on Martin's otherwise immaculate white shirt.
You're the man of the house now.
And with that, he turned around and opened the wooden door. Past his father, Martin could see that the sun was just beginning to rise over the tops of the trees of the dark forest on the other side of the clearing in which their house sat. A fog, thick like broth and grey like storm clouds, covered the ground all the way to the edge of the trees, completely obscuring his father up to the knees as he stepped into it.
Won't you say goodbye to Margaret and little Freddy before you go?
Martin called after him desperately. His father paused briefly in the fog and did not look back. After a few moments' hesitation, he adjusted the large satchel on his shoulder, shook his head, his long greasy black hair quivering as he simply said,
No.
And strode off across the clearing, moving through the fog slowly and steadily, like a ship leaving harbour. Martin wiped the snot from his nose with his hand and watched through the tears as his father made his way inexorably to the edge of the wood, pausing again briefly at the tree line before stepping forward and disappearing into the darkness. Martin stared into that darkness for a long time, hoping against hope that his father would re-emerge and bound back across the clearing, gathering up his son in his arms and declaring that it had all been a test. He would pick him up and hold him tight like he used to, kissing him on the forehead. Of course he wouldn't leave him alone to look after his brother and sister for the next 4 days. He could never be expected to do that. He was only 11. Martin continued to stare out the door at the cold light of the sun as it rose a little higher in the sky, cutting through the fog, making it translucent. Something moved in the woods, not far from where he had last seen his father, and his heart leapt in his chest for a brief moment before the shape resolved into that of a fox, staring intensely at him. It stepped out into the sunlight, and Martin could see that its face was bloodied, and in its jaws it held the limp form of a large grey rat. Martin darted forward to the door and threw it closed, the sound reverberating around the small cottage as he turned the huge key that secured the door and the mechanism locked into place with a deep and final sounding clunk. It was at that point that Martin realised his father had really left. Martin stood precariously on a stool, leaning over the top of the stew pot that sat on the top of the stove, ladle in one hand, bowl in the other. There wasn't very much stew left. Behind him, his 8-year-old sister Margaret and a 5-year-old brother Frederick sat at the wooden table in the main room of the cottage, their long black hair greasy and unwashed. Neither of them looked well. On the far wall, a fire burned weakly in the fireplace, crackling and fizzing now and again. Martin filled the bowl, put it down on the shelf next to the stove, before grabbing and filling another one. Then he hung up the spoon, hopped down off the stool, picked up the bowls and brought them over to the table, placing one in front of each of his siblings. Margaret looked morosely at the meagre offering in front of her.
"Can't we have something else today?"
she asked, moving the stew around the bowl with a small wooden spoon.
"There isn't anything else," said Martin flatly. "Look, Freddy's eating his."
Margaret looked over at her little brother, who was eagerly shoveling food into his mouth, barely pausing to breathe.
"But it's breakfast time," Margaret whined. "You can't have stew for breakfast." "There's no more porridge or apples. This is all that's left."
Martin reached out for her bowl.
"Look, if you don't want it, I'll have it."
Margaret's arm shot out and grabbed the bowl off the table and held it close to her chest, splashing a little on her dirty blue dress.
No, 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 I'll eat it,
she stammered, desperation showing briefly in her eyes. As Martin backed away, she set the bowl back down on the table and began to gather it up on the spoon.
Can we have it warm for dinner?
She mumbled weakly. Martin looked over at the three logs crackling in the fireplace.
I'll have to go check the wood pile, he grumbled, though there was no malice in it.
This seemed to satisfy her a little as she finally began to eat. Across the table from her, Freddy held up a spoon above his head.
Finished!
He announced, grinning. That's good, Freddy, Martin said as he grasped his brother's bowl and carried it over to a separate shelf that contained a few other dirty dishes. As he did so, Freddy asked him the same question he had asked every morning for the last 2 weeks.
Is father coming home today?
I don't know, Freddy, Martin said, feeling a lump in his throat as he said it. I didn't know yesterday, and I won't know tomorrow.
I hope he comes home soon, Freddy went on. My ribs are getting even bigger.
For the last time, your ribs aren't getting bigger, Freddy, Martin barked impatiently. You're just getting thinner.
You said he was coming back on Sunday,
Freddy went on matter-of-factly.
And now there have been...
He paused for a moment and counted on his fingers.
3 Sundays.
He'll be back soon, Martin barked angrily.
He stood there breathing heavily as they both stared at him in shock. He felt tears begin to well up in his eyes as he darted off through the nearest door, which happened to be his father's bedroom. He slammed the door behind him and leant his back against it, shuddering. Closing his eyes, he concentrated, trying to ignore the huge pit of hunger he felt in his stomach. He'd been rationing the stew very heavily, and it had been a few days since he'd eaten anything at all himself, electing instead to feed his siblings and tell them he had already eaten before they had gotten up. He blinked the tears out of his eyes and stumbled across the room, bare as it was, save for a handmade double bed, a large wooden chest, and his mother's old looking glass, lying propped in the corner. He stopped in front of the mirror and looked at himself in the dull light from the overcast sky as it shone weakly in through the window. He did not recognize the face that stared back at him with its sunken eyes, yellowed where they had once been white. He and his siblings had always been pale, but now that paleness had taken on a washed-out quality. He turned his face slightly to the side and felt as though he could clearly see the shape of his own skull beneath his tight, stretched skin. Grasping the bottom of his shirt, he pulled it up to reveal his torso. His stomach was now a concave recess, bracketed on either side by the deep, dark lines of his ribs. Freddy was right. They did almost give him the impression that they were getting bigger, though he knew this was most certainly not the case. He let his stained, once white shirt flop back down, and he tucked it back into his belt. He sighed, turned away from the monster in the mirror, and walked across the room, opening the door and closing it gently behind him. Martin sat at the bar table and watched Freddy as he knelt on the stool, looking out the window to, as he put it,
be the first to greet father when he returns. Do you think father caught the thing that got mummy?
He said, not dragging his gaze from the clearing outside.
Mother got a cold in her chest, Freddy. The doctor said so, said Margaret from where she sat on the floorboards next to the fire,
her dress pulled up around her as she held her hands out to the weak flames to warm them.
She was sick and it took her. That just happens sometimes.
That's not what father told me, Freddy said petulantly. Father said there was a crooked thing in the forest that came in the night and drank her blood until she didn't have none left.
That's not true, Freddy, said Martin, trying not to snap at the boy. Maggie's right. She just got sick.
Father wouldn't lie to me,
Freddy said, still staring out the window. Martin and Margaret exchanged glances across the room.
Well, he didn't really lie to you, Martin said, drumming his fingers nervously on the table. He just, well, he isn't right in the head like he used to be.
What's wrong with his head?
Said Freddy, finally dragging his watchful eye from the window to look over at his brother.
Did he hurt it?
No, it's not like that, said Martin, struggling to find the words.
Do you remember how sad we all were when Mummy died?
Margaret cut in, much to Martin's relief.
Freddy nodded his head.
Well, father was so sad that he hurt himself inside.
She tapped the side of her head.
So, sometimes he thinks pretend things aren't pretend.
Do you understand, Freddy? Said Martin, hopefully.
Freddy looked at both of their faces briefly, before turning back to the window silently and staring outside once more. Martin was awoken by a shrill wail. He sat up in the darkness and looked towards the source of the sound. Freddy was jumping up and down next to the window, lit only by the moonlight. Tears ran down his face as he screamed,
"The crooked thing! The crooked thing! I saw the crooked thing!"
Margaret leapt out of her bed with the blanket wrapped around her and grabbed Freddy's shoulders firmly.
"Freddy, stop it!" she said impatiently. "You just had a nightmare." "No, it was outside! I saw it!" he insisted.
"No, you didn't," Margaret said, stifling a yawn. "Look, I'll show you."
Margaret stood up and took a step over to the window, sighing. Suddenly, she recoiled away from the pain as her hand shot up to her mouth.
"Oh my God!"
she hissed as she stumbled backwards. Martin jumped up out of bed and rushed across the room, his nightshirt tails dragging across the ground as he pushed past his brother and sister to the window. He looked out across the clearing, silvery moonlight bathing everything in an ethereal glow. In the distance, he saw a dark shape moving at the tree line before it disappeared into the darkness. He stared intently for another few moments, but saw nothing moving.
"What did you see, Maggie?" he said, still squinting into the night.
"Eyes," she whispered, trembling. "They flashed at me."
Martin puzzled over this for a second and then remembered something.
"It must have been that fox," he said,
a mild relief flooding through him as his heart began to slow.
"It's been skulking around since Father left."
"It wasn't a fox,"
Freddy shouted as Margaret pulled him close.
"It was big," Margaret said, clearly frightened, "like a man."
Martin continued to stare out into the night, a cold dread now mixing with the hole he felt in his stomach. It was almost a relief to feel something in there other than hunger. Almost. The next morning, Martin sat at the table alone once again, though this time both his brother and sister stared out the window across the room. Freddy again on the stool, Maggie stood beside him, still wrapped in her blanket to guard against the cold, hands resting on the windowsill. In the fireplace sat the last two logs, unlit. Martin stared into space, his head nodding over now and again as he kept almost falling asleep, pulling back at the last second. His hunger had become a dull throbbing in his gut that he had almost gotten used to now. He looked over at his brother and sister at the window dreamily and laughed. It had just been a fox. How could they be so stupid? He laughed quietly to himself and he leaned forward to put his head down on the table, immediately falling into a deep, fretful sleep. Later he awoke, picking his head up from the table to look around the dark room. He stood up, crossed the floor without thinking at all and went into the bedroom where Margaret and Frederick were already fast asleep themselves. He lay down carefully on the bed and curled up under the blanket, not bothering to get undressed. From the window, a pair of eyes watched intently as he turned over and passed out again almost immediately.
"What's wrong with him?"
Margaret whispered to Martin. She was sitting on the edge of Freddy's bed, rubbing his back as the boy leant over the edge and retched into the chamber pot. Martin stood next to them, silently panicking but outwardly remaining stoic, mainly because he didn't know what to do. Freddy coughed and a small, circular orange object hit the thin layer of black mucus in the chamber pot. Martin knelt down for a closer look. It was a half-digested slice of carrot. Freddy threw himself back onto the bed, eyes wide open, clearly exhausted, breathing heavily and staring at the ceiling, his face soaked with sweat.
"What do we do?"
Margaret looked desperately to her big brother. Martin looked into her eyes and remembered what his father had said before he left. "You're the man of the house now."
"He needs water," Martin said confidently, pretending certainty. It seemed to work.
"I'll go fetch some,"
said Margaret, hopping up off the bed and running out of the room. Martin stood up straight, stepped forward, pushed the chamber pot out of the way with his foot, and sat down on the bed next to Freddy. He put his hand on the boy's forehead the way he remembered his mother doing when they had been feeling poorly. His clammy skin felt cold to the touch, not warm as he had expected it to.
"Can you eat?"
said Martin, adjusting his hand to grasp the boy's chin and turning his face towards him.
"It's breakfast time."
Freddy blinked at Martin, focusing on him with what seemed like a lot of effort.
"I'm going to eat with Father,"
the child croaked.
"He has honey and chocolates."
He looked around the room excitedly.
"Where is he?"
"I don't know, Freddy,"
Martin said, barely hiding his frustration with the question.
I'm sure he'll be home soon.
But he's home already,
said Freddy, frowning.
He came home last night. Don't you remember?
You were just dreaming, Freddy, Martin said softly, biting back on his instinct to tell the boy off for saying such a thing.
No, I was awake,
Freddy insisted, seeming now much more lucid. He raised his shoulders up slightly and grabbed his brother's shirt sleeve.
He said he'd be coming back tonight to get me, and I can go live with him in the forest.
Don't say such things,
Margaret rasped from the doorway behind Martin. She strode across the floor and held out a white cup filled with water.
Here, there's not much left in the jug and it smells a bit funny.
Martin sniffed it. It didn't smell bad, but there was a staleness to it that he couldn't deny. He shrugged and put it to Freddy's lips. The boy grasped at it with both hands and guzzled at it greedily, before spluttering and coughing, spraying Martin in the face. He pulled it away from the boy forcefully.
Stop that! You'll make yourself sick again, he groaned, putting the cup down on the floor. Now, you lie there and rest for a while.
Freddy lay back down and shut his eyes, beginning to snore weakly almost straight away. Martin pulled the bedclothes up around Freddy's neck, stood up, and walked past Margaret, who followed him out of the room, shutting the door quietly behind her. Martin dragged the stool over from the window to the stove and carefully climbed up on top of it, feeling more than a little dizzy.
You need to eat, he said, turning his head to look over at Margaret. Fetch me the ladle and a bowl.
As she walked over to the other side of the room to do so, Martin lifted the lid from the stew pot. Hundreds of tiny flies came erupting out of the pot like a cloud of dust motes. The smell of rotten meat and vegetables hit Martin in the face like a fist as he reflexively moved backwards away from the foul stench. His ankle twisted as he fell backwards off the stool, spinning around as he sailed through the air and landed hard on the floor, face first. Margaret yelped and ran over to him, crouching down in an effort to help him up, but found herself to be far too weak. He turned over and sat up as she fell down on her knees beside him, leaning on his shoulder with her bony, tiny hand. He looked at her as she sat there sobbing, wondering at how much her face had become so much like a skull. It had been so gradual he had barely noticed. She had been so vibrant and seemingly energetic that it hadn't really struck him until now, as she started to cry, just how completely worn down and weak she had become. In that moment, he almost didn't recognize her. He put his own bony hand on hers and squeezed it. Did Freddy eat the stew yesterday? She sniffed and looked at him wide-eyed from her thin lips, pulling into a grimace.
He was so hungry, she whined.
Did you eat too?
Martin asked, keeping his voice as level as he could to hide his fear. Her lips became a thin line as she nodded. He looked into her tired, sorrowful eyes, lifted his hands from the floor, and put his arms around her, and hugged her tight. She squeezed him back weakly and whispered,
Why did Father leave us here like this?
I don't know, he said, doing his best to feign strength, but we can't stay here any longer. We'll have to get some rest, and then we'll head to Gerwick.
She wriggled out of his grasp and leaned away from him.
But that's too far, she groaned. It'll take days.
We can't stay here, Martin said as he struggled awkwardly to his feet, trying to ignore the pain in his ankle. We have to go. We'll have to wait a little bit and see if Freddy gets any better, and then we'll go. Then she whispered, finally giving voice to the niggling thought Martin had been trying to ignore. What if he doesn't get better? Maggie rushed into the bedroom and shook Martin awake. As he stared sleepily up at her gaunt face, there was an aspect to her expression that told him there was something deeply wrong.
Freddy's gone,
she screamed hoarsely.
What?
Martin growled, looking over at the bed beside his and, finding it empty, threw the covers off his own bed, jumped out onto the bare floor. A shock of pain from his ankle surprised him as he landed, reminding him of his fall the day before as he half-hopped, half-limped out of the bedroom, across the floor of the main room and out the front door, which Margaret had left wide open. The frost that lay on the ground bit at the soles of his feet, but he ignored it as he looked desperately around the clearing for any sign of his brother. It was deathly quiet, save for the sound of the branches of the trees creaking in the wind. Not a single animal could be heard anywhere around. Usually the forest was alive with birdsong at this time of the morning, even in the dead of winter. About 10 yards from the west side of the cottage stood the outhouse, a small wooden hut with a ramshackle door made from uneven planks. He limped quickly over to it and flung back the door, finding it empty, save for a few flies and an unpleasant smell.
Flinging the door closed again, he stumbled awkwardly around the house, screaming at the top of his lungs for Freddy. When he got back around to the front of the house, he found Margaret bent over in the doorway, her left hand leaning on the frame as she retched. A small mound of the little food she had in her stomach lay at her feet. She looked up at him, her face a pale shade of green, as she gave him an apologetic look, before her knees buckled and she collapsed in the doorway. It had taken every ounce of strength he could muster, but Martin had managed to drag his sister from the doorway to the bedroom and lift her up onto her bed. As she lay there on her side on top of the blankets, her breaths grew shallower and shallower. He had tried speaking to her, but if she could hear him, she didn't have the strength to answer. A chill ran through him as he stood over her and he realized he had left the front door open. He left the bedroom and turned to see, lying there in the doorway, a fox. He didn't know if it was the same one he had seen the day his father had left, but if it was, the time since then had not been kind to it. Its ribs were almost as pronounced as his own, and he could see patches of blood on its fur. Its hind legs lay flat on the ground as it dragged itself along with its front legs. Behind it, on the frosty ground outside, Martin could see a long trail of blood where it had pulled itself along to get to the doorway. It looked up at him pitifully and growled half-heartedly as its front legs strained and quivered to keep it upright. Martin darted across the room to the small rack where the knives hung and pulled the biggest one down. The handle was of a dark brown wood and the blade was about a foot long and razor sharp. He sidled back around the table, keeping his eye on the fox the entire time. As he watched, its front legs folded up beneath it and it laid its head down on the floor, though its eyes remained locked on Martin's as it began to cough. A small amount of blood spread out of its mouth and onto the floorboards as its head flopped over to the side and its tongue lolled out. Martin approached the still creature very carefully, with the knife held out in front of him, but its eyes, once desperate and afraid, now looked glassy and did not move. He reached out and hit the animal's nose with the flat of the blade a few times before he was satisfied that it wasn't going to move again. He threw the knife on the table, quickly ran into the bedroom and picked up his black trousers, putting them on quickly, tucking his nightshirt into them. Then he grasped his black shoes and sat down in the bed to buckle them on, being very careful of his ankle. As he did so, he looked over at Maggie, who was still lying on her side with her eyes closed, her shoulder rising and falling only very slightly with each breath. He limped back out of the room and hobbled his way over to the dead fox in the doorway. Once there, he grabbed the broom that rested against the side of the door and began pushing the corpse back outside onto the cold ground. Once he had shoved it about 20 yards from the door, he moved around it and crouched down beside it, groaning at the pain in his ankle and the weakness in his legs. There were wounds all over its hindquarters, one wound much larger than the others. It was vaguely circular and ragged around the edges, as if something had bitten a big chunk out of the beast. A loud cracking sound caught Martin's attention, and he turned his head to look over towards the tree line. A few branches shook, as if something had been there and taken off just before he looked. He suddenly felt very vulnerable out here on his own as he got up and limped quickly back towards the door, using the broom as a walking stick. He stumbled through the doorway, spun around and shut the door, turning the key in the lock. He moved over to the window next to the door and stared out, watching for any more movement. As he stared out the window, a few flakes of snow fell down and stuck to the glass. Within a few seconds, the snow was pouring out of the sky in a flurry. In a few minutes, the ground outside was solid white. A few minutes after that, the corpse of the fox was completely obscured. Margaret lay on an arrangement of blankets a few feet in front of the hearth as the fire burned fiercely. Martin leaned down and took another chair leg from the pile of wood he had made on the floor and threw it in, causing the fire to dull for a moment before the flames licked all the way around and over it. He had tried to take the table apart too, but it had proven to be beyond both his ability and his strength. But there were more than enough bits of chair left to last the night, he was sure. "Maggie," he said quietly. She did not respond, but he hadn't really expected her to. She hadn't made a sound for a few hours now. He limped back over to the window by the door and stared out at the darkness. There was no moon tonight, but the snow outside was still lit a little by the light of the stars. "I don't know what to do, Maggie," he said, not looking around. "We can't stay here. There's no food, and Father isn't coming back." He smiled and laughed a humorless laugh. He told me I was the man of the house. Now Freddy's gone. And you. He finally looked over at her. She was very still. Maggie? Martin dragged Maggie's limp, lifeless body into the bedroom and hoisted her up onto her bed. After wrapping her up in the blankets, he took one of her blue headscarves out of the wardrobe and held it over her head. He looked at her glassy, dead eyes one last time before dropping the scarf and covering her face. After that, he went back into the wardrobe and took out another of her headscarves, a long black cloak, and a pair of leather gloves. He limped out into the main room once more, being careful to close the bedroom door firmly behind him, knowing it was the last time he ever would. He placed the headscarf on his head and tied the ends under his chin before wrapping the cloak around himself and lying down in front of the fire. He realized then that he didn't really feel hungry anymore. In his stomach, he just felt a burning, stabbing pain. That night, it was all he dreamed of. When Martin awoke in the morning, the fire was nothing but ash, with a few glowing embers, but there was still some heat coming off it. The light coming in the window was vibrant and bright as it reflected off the snow, allowing him to see clearly that the door to the bedroom was ajar. He jumped up onto his feet and rushed over to it as fast as his ankle would allow, throwing the door open all the way. Maggie was gone, as were the blankets she had been wrapped in. The blue headscarf he had put over her face, identical to the one he now wore himself, lay on the floor at the foot of the bed. He looked over at the window and found it closed and intact. He ran out to the front door and found it still firmly locked. He turned around with his back to the door and looked about the room, baffled. He then spoke to the empty room.
Maggie?
Silence. After he was satisfied there would be no response, he grabbed the long knife from the table and tucked it into his belt. Then he adjusted the cloak around himself, tightened the headscarf, and put on the gloves. He turned the key and opened the door onto a world of white, broken only by the darkness between the trees, which were themselves laden with snow. He stepped through the doorway and the snow crunched beneath his feet as they sank into it. For a moment, he considered locking the door behind him, but instead left it wide open as he walked away across the clearing. When he got to the mound of snow where he knew the fox to be buried, he paused and stirred in shock. A small part of the snow had been cleared away, and there, surrounded by reddened snow, was the head of the fox. Most of the skin and muscle had been peeled away from it, leaving a mostly bare skull. He looked around and saw tracks in the snow leading away towards the woods. He followed them with his eyes back to his position, and then further back, realizing he'd been walking alongside them the whole time. He looked behind him towards the cottage, and saw that they led all the way from the front door, just beside his own. They were much too big to belong to either Freddy or Maggie, he knew. Someone had been in the house last night. Had they taken Maggie away? Had they also come for Freddy? Would they be coming for him? He grit his teeth together, drew the knife from his belt, and made his way through the snow, following the tracks all the way to the tree line. Once he got there, the tracks continued, though they were less obvious, as the snow was thinner here under the branches of the forest. He lost all thought of travelling to Gerwick, which was in the opposite direction, as he stomped along angrily, staring down at the tracks as he followed them through the dark woods, moving as fast as his twisted ankle would allow. After following them for about half an hour, he saw, through the trees in the distance, a canvas tent in a small clearing. He crept along as quietly as he could until he heard movement. He stopped and ducked behind a tree, leaning out to observe the mouth of the tent with one eye. The tent shook and rustled as a figure with long black hair ducked out of the opening and stood up straight. Martin stared in disbelief at the weather-beaten face of his father. The man turned away and walked further into the clearing so that Martin could no longer see. He slowly sidled out from behind the tree and limped slowly forward until he had a view of the entire clearing. Strangely, there was no snow on the ground here. In the centre of the clearing was a mound of dirt, 10 feet high and about twice as wide. In clumps all over the mound there grew little white chrysanthemums. At the base of it, on this side, was a hole about 3 feet high and wide that led into the mound. Lying on the ground in front of this hole he could see the body of Maggie, still wrapped in the blankets he had put her in. Standing a few feet further away, his father cupped his hands around his mouth and screamed at the mound.
"Is this good enough for you now?"
Then he fell down on his knees, hands clasped together in front of him as he muttered to himself, Martin stumbled out from his hiding place and into the clearing, his head buzzing with questions, but only one managing to make it to his lips.
"What are you doing?"
he growled, pointing at his father with the end of the knife. His father's head whipped around and looked at the boy in shock. He got to his feet with a quizzical look on his face and muttered,
"I told you to stay out of the woods."
Martin's gaze moved from his father to the body of Margaret, lying a few feet behind him. His father followed his gaze and then looked back at his son, his face a mix of shame and anger.
"Look, you wouldn't understand.
You let us starve,"
Martin screamed.
"You left us and you didn't come back."
"Son, I did it for the family,"
said his father weakly.
"I did it for all of us."
"Your head's rotten,"
Martin screamed as he rushed towards his father, half hopping as his anger overrode the pain in his leg. His father flailed at him and held out his arms, trying to slow the boy, but he was not nearly quick enough as Martin drove the blade into his father's belly, all the way to the handle. The man fell backwards, landing heavily on the ground, as Martin stared in disbelief at what he had just done. His father reached up and grasped the handle of the knife and, in one smooth movement, pulled it out of his gut and tossed it aside before sitting up. He held his hand across his belly as blood poured out from between his fingers.
"Well done, boy," he said, smiling at his son. "Reckon I deserve that. But you should probably be on your way now. She'll not be happy that you're here."
"Who?"
Martin began, but was interrupted by a deep, guttural sound coming from the direction of the mound. His eyes were drawn towards the hole in the base of the mound as the sound slowly resolved itself into a voice.
"Nathaniel, have you brought me another?"
it intoned. Martin's father got up on his knees and waved to the boy, shooing him away as he fought through the pain in his belly, mouthing the word "hide" before he struggled around to face the hole and shouted,
"I have, as was our agreement."
Martin hesitated for a moment before he turned and ran back to the tree he had been hiding behind before. He leaned out from behind it, watching with one eye.
"Ah, yes,"
the voice rumbled as a long grey pair of arms extended out of the hole in the mound. The hands at the end of the arms had long, spindly fingers, each one tipped with a curved black fingernail that ended in a sharp point. The clawed hands grasped Maggie's recumbent form, digging the nails in tight as it dragged the body easily into the hole and out of sight.
"Are you satisfied yet, beast? Will you bring my wife back to me?"
The voice of the thing made a dreadful sound that Martin felt more than heard as he gripped the tree tightly. It sounded like laughter, though it bore only a passing resemblance to any Martin had ever heard. The dirt immediately in front of the hole in the mound began to shift and undulate as something broke the surface. It was a pair of human hands, slender, pale, and completely clean of dirt. A pair of arms, a head, and shoulders soon followed them. The naked woman climbed out of the ground easily and stood up straight in front of Martin's father, her pale skin almost as white as the flowers on the mound, her hair red as blood. He began to cry as the woman slowly approached him. From his vantage point behind the tree, Martin stared at his mother, fighting the urge to break cover and run to her. He knew this wasn't right. He'd seen them put her in the ground and bury her. She walked forward until she was right in front of Martin's father and put a hand on either side of his head. Then, smiling, she looked into his eyes and spoke.
"You were supposed to come alone."
And with that, she grasped each side of his head tight, twisted and lifted, pulling the man's head off as he let out a short and final scream. Blood spread out of the now headless neck, showering the ground all around, but somehow the mother thing remained completely untouched by it. She threw the man's head casually to the side and then turned her head to look directly at the spot where Martin was hiding. It smiled at him, exposing two rows of needle-sharp teeth, and spoke again.
"Leave this place and speak of this to no one."
Martin took off running as fast as his twisted ankle would take him, flinging himself forward through the trees in his half-hopping limp, the whole time feeling unseen teeth and claws biting, scratching, and clawing just behind him, though he did not look around to see.
He ran and ran until he could not run any more, so he crawled until his knees and hands bled. Sometime later, along a trail at the edge of the forest, a small group of travelling traders came across a boy, crawling around like an animal, half mad and starving. After a few days, when they had fed him and allowed him to recuperate, they tried to find out who he was and where he was from, but the boy refused to speak. And though he lived for a long time afterwards, he never spoke again, for fear he would break his unspoken promise and let slip what he had seen between the trees.